You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, August 18, 2010, Colonel Keith Gibson, VMI's Director of Museum Operations, delivered a presentation on the Virginia Military Institute in the Civil War. Founded in 1839 in Lexington, Virginia, VMI supplied the fledgling Confederacy with a large number of military leaders. Almost 2,000 VMI graduates eventually served in the Southern Army. During the war, the Cadet Corps drilled voluntary infantry regiments as they arrived to defend Virginia and played a significant battlefield role at the May 15, 1864 Confederate victory at New Market. When a gaping hole appeared in the Confederate front line, the youngsters were ordered in. The price, 10 dead and 47 wounded. This is the fourth in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Keith Gibson.
Thanks, sir.
Well, I think I need to mention, just in starting, that I do not have a part-time job as a bus driver. This is the new U.S. Army uniform, literally brand new. It's just been adopted. So VMI, like all the rest of the Army, has gone into it this fall. It is a, in a couple of you were asking actually before, a little earlier, you're either in your ACUs, your Army combat uniform. They're the ones, you know, the digicam, you know, the green things. You know, and if I'd worn that, I would be invisible. And so I decided to dress up for you. And if I were to put my blue jacket on, I would be in dress blues. But without the blue jacket, you're in your, this is now the new daily duty uniform. So we're all trying to adjust to it and see how it's going to fit in the classroom, because these blue pants with white chalk dust, you know, sort of a magnet. But we'll see. We'll see how it works. It's a big topic I have this evening to share with you. And it starts not in April of 1861, but a few years earlier. That's perfect. If you can see the images, that's perfect. Throwing away the scabbard. The raw December cold of the New York docks couldn't dampen the spirits of Francis Henny Smith's return home to the States. The 46-year-old superintendent of Virginia Military Institute had been in Europe for the previous 6 months of 1858, touring the best universities there, and was aflame with the prospects of coming back to Virginia and implementing these ideas that he had experienced. Smith was returning home to Lexington on the other side of the mountains. His purpose now was to create the nation's first school of the general sciences, just as a few years earlier he had created the nation's first state-sponsored military college, VMI. He would organize VMI now into a polytechnic university of the model that he had experienced in Europe, with three special schools: architecture, agriculture, and fine arts. The 1860s, in Smith's mind, held great promise. Colonel Smith's school, actually, in the Valley of Virginia, was no stranger to new ideas. Indeed, VMI had been founded 20 years earlier, as I mentioned, as the nation's first state-sponsored military college, the location of one of the state's two arsenals. But while attending their course of study, the cadets performed the very real task of guarding those arsenals that stand of 30,000 arms for the defense of Western Virginia beyond the ridge of the Blue Ridge. With the creation of the citizen soldier as its mission, The Institute prepared young Virginians with a solid academic program in a strict military environment. Year after year, the rhythm of the daily schedule became a part of each cadet's habits. 5:30 a.m., reveille was beaten on the drum. Breakfast at 7, classes from 8 to 4 p.m., an hour break and dinner for at noon at 1 o'clock. Drill on the parade ground at 4 p.m. with a daily parade 30 minutes before sundown every day. Supper followed the parade, a call to quarters 30 minutes after returning from supper, tattoo at 9:30 with taps at 10 p.m. The mess hall bill fare was offered no more diversity than the academic schedule. For breakfast, good coffee or tea, hot corn cakes, fresh light bread, cold meat, good butter. For dinner, I'm amused at the fact that they had to stipulate that it was good coffee and good butter, as opposed to the other kind. Two kinds of meat for dinner, two kinds of vegetables, warm cornbread, cold wheat bread, and for supper, good coffee or tea, and good bread and butter with plain dessert. Plain dessert once a week. Nothing like going to the University of Virginia, where you have dessert every day. The work of the new academic year was hardly underway in mid-October 1859 when the Lexington community learned that John Brown's raid at the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry had taken place. Now, if a federal arsenal only 120 miles away to the north had been attacked, what might happen to the state arsenals? Colonel Smith immediately tendered the service of the cadet corps to the governor. For the moment, his plans for a polytechnic institution had to be set aside. John Brown was brought to trial during the last week of October. Mr. Lawson Botts, VMI class of 1844, was appointed by the court to represent Mr. Brown. He was fairly quickly removed from that position. Mainly Boston abolitionists hired what they considered an appropriate attorney for Mr. Brown. By the 2nd of November, however, a verdict had been announced. Treason to the Commonwealth. Conspiring with slaves to commit treason and murder. Yesterday, Brown wrote his wife, I was sentenced to be hanged on December the 2nd, next. Now, fearing an attempt to free Brown, Governor Henry Wise called every available military organization under his command to Charlestown. Smith prepared the cadet corps for field duty. Orders to march arrived by courier at 8 p.m. on November the 25th. 2 hours later, 96 cadets and officers departed Lexington down the Shenandoah Valley northward to Harper's Ferry. Majors William Gillam and Raleigh Colston accompanied the cadets. Major Tom Jackson, in his seventh year as professor of natural philosophy and artillery tactics, went along to command the cadet artillery. The Superintendent Smith, in fact, would be appointed to preside over the execution. The day of the execution dawned overcast. The cadets set aside their gray overcoats in favor of bright red wool shirts with white cross belts. Wishing to encourage good relations with the eminent agronomist Edmund Ruffin, Colonel Smith authorized him to don a cadet uniform and join the ranks of the cadets. My position was very amusing, perhaps ludicrous to the young men, and it required all the restraint of their good manners to hide their merriment, recall the War of 1812 veteran with his long flowing white hair, as you see here. Ruffin, you might remember, would later claim the distinction of firing the first shot of the war at Fort Sumter, with the Citadel cadets looking on, in fact. Well, the VMI cadets were posted immediately behind the gallows. The execution is over. We have just returned from the field, wrote Professor John Preston to his wife. Colonel Smith announced, we are ready, and John Brown was hanging between heaven and earth. Returning to Lexington, the Corps found it difficult to settle down to an academic routine. The schedule was offered to provide really little academic pursuit, much more time for bayonet drill and musket practice. At the request of the governor, Major William Gillam was preparing a new manual to train volunteer forces for the state. The class of 1860 prepared for its final exams and its graduation on July the 4th. Two prominent academics visiting from the United States Military Academy would administer the final oral exams, Professor Dennis Mahan and William Hardee, Commandant of West Point. Superintendent Smith, a graduate of West Point, class of 1833 himself, had fond memories of Professor Mahan from his cadetship. But despite these warm relations, troubles after John Brown's execution made all attending these exercises anxious over the future of the nation and of Virginia. The graduating class of 1860 reflected this sentiment in the ring that they had designed. It said, "Let Virginia choose." During this time, tensions also ran high between the Unionist Lexingtonians and the secession-leaning interests found on the campuses of Washington College and VMI. Those boys going to college there primarily were coming from Tidewater, Virginia, a few from Piedmont. On one occasion, a rumor spread that a cadet had been accosted by a Unionist mob on Main Street in town. The Corps poured out of the barracks with loaded muskets, determined to avenge the attack. Was the first battle of the Civil War about to erupt on the streets of Lexington? After all, the town had been named after the Revolutionary War battle. It seemed theoretically possible. Well, the quick-thinking superintendent interceded and declared that if the cadets were going into a fight, that he would be leading them. But first, he wished to address them back at the barracks. So they dutifully marched back following his orders. Well, while he was there, as Colonel Smith attempted to defuse the situation, Major Jackson entered the assembly hall. The cadets demanded to know what their quirky professor's view about succession and the impending war might be. "The time," said Jackson, "has not come for war, but when it does, we must draw the sword and throw away the scabbard." The hall erupted with cheers of approval from his adoring cadets. 9 months later, on April the 17th, 1861, the time had come, and Virginia leaves the Union. Academic work unrelated to military pursuits discontinued. Throughout the North and South, actually, colleges were seeing their faculty and student ranks decimated by the call to arms, including here in Charlottesville. The survival of VMI was found in its distinct nature. "We are never wanted the advantages of military instruction more than now," General Robert E. Lee proclaimed, "and the Virginia Military Institute is the best and purest fountain from which we can be supplied," he concluded. Early in the summer of 1861, Smith offered the battalion of cadets to Confederate government for active field service. "While most students," said Smith, "of the University of Virginia and Washington College are taken to the field as private soldiers, I do not wish to see our cadet corps to be in the background." Well, a joint recommendation from President Davis, Virginia Governor Letcher, and the Confederate Congress denied Superintendent Smith's request and ordered VMI back into regular session. The Confederate Congress, however, was already discussing the idea of a national military college. Until such an academy could be established, President Davis chose to appoint cadets to several colleges in the South offering military instruction. VMI would get the lion's share of those. Indeed, virtually every state destined to join the Confederacy had established a college based on the VMI military model. Orders arrived on April the 20th, 1861, for William Gillem to assume command of the camp of instruction that was being established in Richmond. This dispatch also called out the cadet corps. They were to act as drill instructors. Quote, "The corps will prove their birth and breeding and exhibit to Virginia the worth of her favorite institution." He wasn't talking about the University of Virginia. It was the VMI. As I quote orders number 63, which went on to appoint Major T.J. Jackson to command the march. At 12:30 on April the 21st, precisely at the time indicated in his orders, the man who would soon become known as Stonewall shouted his first commands of the Civil War. "Right face, by file left, march." The cadets reveled in this important task that they had been given. They obviously enjoyed the attention of the Richmonders visiting Camp Lee, particularly the young ladies. The thousands of volunteers on the receiving end, however, of the cadets' instruction were not always as enthusiastic. "Reveille was a misery," wrote George Bagby of Lynchburg, who explained that, I was 33 years old, a born invalid whose habits had been to rise late, bathe leisurely. It sounds like Rick Britton, but it's not. Rise late, bathe leisurely, and eat breakfast after everybody else was done. To get up at dawn to be drilled by a fat little cadet, young enough to be my son, of the Virginia Military Institute, well, that indeed is misery. How I hated that little cadet. I have that feeling sometimes. He was always so wide awake, so clean, so interested in the drill. His coattails were so short and sharp. His hands looked so big in his white gloves. He made me sick, George Bagley concluded. Well, between April the 23rd and July the 18th, the Corps drilled an estimated 15,000 green recruits for the Confederate service. By late July, the need for company-grade junior officers resulted in a majority of those cadets leaving the Corps for posts around Virginia. The Corps was officially dismissed with orders to resume studies in Lexington on the 1st of January, 1862. Well, meanwhile, Professor Thomas Jackson had been commissioned colonel, Confederate Army, and was assigned to Harper's Ferry. He was busy with the task of organizing the garrison of recruits that were descending upon that former federal arsenal. Colonel Jackson desires me to send him all the cadets that can be spared from Richmond to aid in instructing his men, wrote General Lee to Colonel Smith on 10 May. The cadets, they're wanted everywhere. Jackson also requested that 5 wagon loads of powder be sent from the arsenal to Lexington, from Lexington to Harper's Ferry under cadet guard. On the eve of the Battle of Manassas, quote, those little soldiers with buttons all over their coats, as the cadets were popularly referred to, found themselves hastily placed in command of the companies that they had recently been drilling. Cadet Charles Norris, seen here, and his brother Rat, classmates, Johnny Moffat, Charles Moore, all 3 from the class of 1864, would die in the First Battle of Manassas, leading the companies against Ricketts' Federal Battery on July the 21st. In that first great land battle, the war had claimed its first cadets. The academic year of 1861-62 passed with little scholarly accomplishment outside the area of military studies. Many of the pre-war faculty, including Professor Jackson, had been placed on leave during the continuance of the war. There was a special military class of 1864, organized primarily of college students from around the state who came to VMI specifically for military instruction. Fearing that the war would end before they could participate, many of these special cadets resigned after completing the most rudimentary training. They wanted to join General Lee in the field. The size of the cadet corps dwindled to less than 100. In April of 1862, military thoughts throughout the South, including VMI, these military schools, they were all but legislated out of existence by a passage of the first Confederate Conscription Act. The Conscription Act called for active military service of all Southern males between 18 and 35 years old. Well, and unless you had some plausible excuse, like you were the local postmaster or something, you had to perform your duty. Well, fearing that schools providing military instruction would become havens for young men seeking to escape, not enhance, their military duty, the act intentionally did not exempt students attending military colleges. Alabama, South Carolina, and Georgia all joined Virginia in strong protest against the conscription of their cadet corps. In a defiant display of states' rights, Governor Letcher ordered Superintendent Smith at VMI not to surrender a single cadet claimed by the conscription to the Confederacy. Letcher was seeking a constitutional battle with the Confederate national government. Well, it was soon clear that President Davis would not enforce the letter of the law and that VMI continued its academic mission. After dropping its minimum age requirement to 16, the VMI Corps grew to an all-time high number of 300 cadets, 50 of whom were appointed by President Davis as Confederate cadets. Cadets under conscription age made up two-thirds of the cadet corps. General Smith had been authorized by the governor to use his discretion to order the cadets into the fields for defense of state property or the surrounding countryside. The Corps, in fact, would be called out 15 times for field service during the course of the war to repel enemy incursions into what Smith very broadly defined as the surrounding countryside. Restlessness in the Corps was replaced with anticipation when the cadets received an unexpected assignment from Professor Jackson. It's April the 30th. "General, please march the cadets at once to Stanton," General Jackson requested, "as many of the cadets' parents may have seen their sons to the Institute for the purpose of keeping them out of the field at present," Jackson conceded. "I can provide for all such cases by assigning them the care of the provisions and baggage trains." Well, knowing that the cadet corps would prefer a more heroic position with the Army, Jackson reminded them that the good patriot serves where he's most needed. In the cold rain, the corps set out from Lexington to join Stonewall. Stonewall on his way to meet the advancing Union General Milroy at the little hamlet of McDowell. Cadet Benjamin Kalana recalled the moment of departure. "The cadets carried their own blankets. Each had a tin cup and a plate, a haversack and a canteen. We were not equipped for as fancy soldiers at all. Our arms were little drill guns, quite unsuited for war. It rained and rained and rained." After being kept at a distance in the rear during the battle, Jackson ordered the cadets forward to the front, up to the burial detail. He wished to dispel any notions of battlefield glory that the young cadet soldiers may have brought with them from the Institute, I think. The school year ended in the traditional date of July the 4th, but without the traditional graduation exercise, there wasn't any graduating first class. 140 cadets entered the summer camp on the VMI parade ground. By September of 1862, Smith began to feel the shortages of a wartime economy. Textbooks, until now imported through the blockade, became scarce. Orders were issued for cadets to turn in, quote, "old underclothing which could be spared without inconvenience." It was left up to the cadets to determine when it became inconvenient, I presume. But these old underclothings would be turned into bandages. A fire destroyed the Institute's tailor shop and the shoe factory, exacerbating Smith's challenge of keeping the cadets in some semblance of uniform. But despite these hardships, the cadets raised $400 for the relief of sick and wounded soldiers, quote-unquote, from Rockbridge County. At sunrise on May the 14th, 1863, the citizens of Lexington woke to the sound of cannon fire from the Institute. The cadet battery, formerly commanded by Professor Thomas Jackson, was firing a memorial salute now, every half an hour until sunset. Jackson had died 4 days earlier and now had returned home for the first time since leaving with the Corps back in April of 61. After lying in state in his section room, guarded by cadets who had only known Jackson as a war hero, never as a professor in the classroom, on the following day, Saturday, May the 15th, the general was buried in Lexington. The 10 graduates of 1863 received a diploma altered to show that it was granted on this fourth day of July in the year of our Lord, 1863, and of the Confederate States, the third. The annual summer encampment began 11 days later with a schedule reflecting its role as military instruction camp. In honor of their fallen hero, the cadets dubbed the exercise Camp Jackson. As late as the summer of 1863, this issue of the official relationship between VMI and the Confederate government still had not been resolved, and General Richard Williamson, Adjutant General of Virginia, interestingly before and after the Civil War, he wrote a letter to President Davis saying, "Sir, it is understood that you regard this institution as being to the Confederate States what West Point was to the late United States, and as possessing the capacity beyond any other Southern institution of training the best officers for the Army. Then I beg leave, therefore, to ask a full and unreserved expression of your opinion upon this subject." Well, Davis tactfully responded that He was pleased with the success of several military schools around the Confederacy and really didn't want to comment on the relative merits of any of them. VMI would have to be content with the public perception that it was the Confederate States Military Academy. In hindsight, if President Davis, in fact, had recognized the Institute officially as the Confederate States Military Academy, it probably would have prohibited VMI from reopening after the war, and there would be potentially no VMI today. An 1863-64 academic year was nearing when Union General William Averill conducted his first of three raids into western Virginia. Although the objectives of Averill's forces were relatively unimportant, they caused great excitement on our side of the mountain, in the Shenandoah Valley and in Lexington, and in the cadet barracks. The cadets took to the field in August, November, December, grueling marches through the mountains in response to these Union threats, perceived or real. Never firing a shot, never being fired upon. These exercises accomplished little more than wearing down of morale and shoe leather. The first anniversary of Jackson's death, May the 10th, 1864. It was a particularly bright Lexington spring day. The Corps marched to the Lexington Cemetery to participate in a memorial service to raise a Confederate flag over Stonewall's grave. The flag was a gift of Jackson's British admirers. Former Governor Letcher spoke to the large crowd there, and he admonished the cadets to rise to the same degree of duty represented by the life of their fallen, lamented Professor Jackson. It would be that very same day, that evening at 9 p.m., that a courier would arrive at General Smith's house, a dispatch from Confederate General Breckinridge. Siegel is moving up the valley. Was at Strasburg last night. I cannot tell you whether this is his destination. I would be glad to have your assistance at once with the cadets and a section of artillery. Bring all the forage and rations you can afford. Well, the Corps departed barracks at 7 a.m. on May the 11th, with hopes that perhaps this march would be more than yet another spring outing. Perhaps this would be their hour of glory. 1 year to the day of Stonewall Jackson's funeral, the cadets were committed to battle at New Market, Virginia, a place and a story with which you are familiar, I'm sure. Fate, more than planning, had positioned the cadets in the center of the Confederate line at the critical moment of the battle. In the confusion, victory hinged on their actions. Heavy Union artillery fire punched a hole in the center of the Confederate line, and the cadet corps moved from a reserve position into that breach and spearheaded a Confederate infantry assault across a rain-drenched wheat field. Breckinridge would later credit his success on May the 15th to the performance of the cadets. Out of a corps of 257, 47 were wounded. 10 cadets died. That evening, Cadet Moses Ezekiel of Company C, here on the left, searched for his roommate, Thomas Garland Jefferson, a descendant of the president. He found his roommate seriously injured, and Moses moved Tom to a nearby home. For 2 days, Ezekiel watched over Tom Jefferson, nephew of the president. Then, in the late evening, Tom asked Moses to read. By the way, Moses Ezekiel is the first Jewish cadet to attend VMI, but Tom Jefferson asked him to read from the New Testament, John chapter 14. In my father's house, there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, and I go now to prepare a place for you. It was only then that it dawned upon me, wrote Ezekiel, that all hope was past. Come and light a candle, cried the dying 17-year-old. It's growing dark. Tom Jefferson died in the arms of Moses Ezekiel. I washed and prepared him for burial, Ezekiel recalled, and carried his mother a lock of hair. The cadets departed from New Market to Richmond with General Breckinridge's forces. They passed through Stanton, Virginia. The ladies of the city presented the corps with a small wreath to adorn the Institute flag. The pine and laurel wreath became a cherished memento of Cadet Ezekiel, and in old age, Moses Ezekiel would present it to the VMI Museum where it is today. In the capital city of Richmond, the cadets were received as the darlings of the Confederacy. A new flag, new uniforms, new infield muskets were presented by President Davis on behalf of the government as a token of thanks. The kits raised the spirits as well as the fighting capacity of the Corps. Soon the cadets were dispatched back to the Institute. In the wake of the Union victory of June the 15th at the Battle of Piedmont, just to the northeast of Stanton, some 35 miles to the north of Lexington, an enemy force now of 15,000 was headed towards Lexington. The cadets entered Lexington just one day ahead of the Union forces under David Hunter. Without firing a shot of resistance, the cadets joined a small unit of Confederates under General John McCausland, class of 1858, and retreated towards Lynchburg. That's where the main stand would be made. The following day, on June the 12th, the Institute was shelled and burned. After being held in reserves in the rain-drenched cemetery all day during the Battle of Lynchburg, the cadets were moved into the front lines on the night of June the 18th. "Wrapping my blanket around me," recalled Cadet John Wise, "I fell asleep, hugging my rifle, never doubting that there would be work for the both of us on the following day. In the morning, it was discovered that the Union forces had been withdrawn during the night." Well, the fire-scarred shell of the Institute greeted the returning cadets. 14 first-classmen were graduated on June the 27th, with summer furlough granted to all others who, quote-unquote, had it within their power to go home or the homes of friends. Much of Virginia was fading in behind the Union lines. On the traditional date of graduation, on July the 4th, General Smith received a private letter from a strong supporter. "I grieve over the destruction of the Institute, but the good that it has done to the country cannot be destroyed, nor can its fame perish. It will rise stronger than before and continue to diffuse its benefits to a grateful people. Under your wise administration, there will be no suspension of its usefulness. With great regards, yours very truly, Robert E. Lee." Indeed, the Superintendent Smith was already making plans to reopen his school. By late summer, Grant's ever-increasing numbers threatened Richmond from the east and south. In October, the Confederate War Department issued emergency orders that the cadets report to Richmond for immediate field service. Now, it was not until mid-December that the cadets were released from Confederate duty. With the Lexington buildings in ruins, Smith would keep the Corps in Richmond, create a temporary VMI, if you will. In this building, the almshouse, the Richmond almshouse, became the quarters for the VMI for the remainder of the war. Determined that even during this trying period, Virginia would not be denied at least one public college, the Board of Visitors insisted that a more rigorous academic schedule be adopted in order to educate officers for the service of our armies and to impart general education to the youth of our country, end quote. During what was the darkest hours of the Confederacy, irony, I think, is found in the fact that VMI would now reinstate a more rigorous academic program that it had been unable to pursue in recent years. Although military arts remained the core of their experience, cadets returned to the study of engineering and mathematics and rhetoric and Latin and France. Yet the dedicated faculty and cadets knew that the eroding situation around them made serious study really all but impossible. In February of 1865, VMI officials tendered the service of the Corps again as drill instructors, this time as part of a plan to arm and train 500,000 slaves as Confederate soldiers. The scheme was too late, actually, to be acted upon, yet the cadets were destined to face black troops. On the night of April the 1st, 1865, it was apparent to us that something out of the ordinary was taking place, explained Cadet Francis Smith. The long roll of the drum summoned the Corps to a formation where they received orders to immediately march to the outer defense lines, some 9 miles distance to the east of Richmond, and relieve General Hood's fatigued units. Going out a quarter of a mile in front of our breastworks on picket the next morning, continued Francis Smith, we found a division of Union Negro troops in front of us. We remained there, constantly expecting attack, and when the tremendous cheering of the enemy was heard, from time to time, we were sure that our time had come. The black soldiers were already responding to what they knew and what the cadets would soon discover. Relieved of their post later that same day, the cadets returned to Richmond. There they witnessed the great pandemonium of the Capitol being abandoned. We halted a while at the Capitol Square, just opposite Old St. Paul's Church, recalled Cadet Francis T. Lee. Once back at the almshouse, the Corps was officially disbanded, quote-unquote, and directed to escape as best we could. General Lee's surrender would come 1 week later, would be 1 week away, but for the Virginia Military Institute Corps of Cadets, the war was officially over. Well, the Institute would be rebuilt and resume its educational mission of the citizen soldier after the war. This image, taken about 1868, shows the superintendent's house, which you will see next week if you come to Lexington. It was not destroyed or burned during Hunter's raid. Smith's daughter had just had a very difficult childbirth, was upstairs in one of the bedrooms. Smith went and petitioned Black Dave Hunter to move her, would threaten her life. So General Hunter moved his headquarters into the superintendent's house for the remainder of his visit in Lexington. The house of Major William Gillem didn't fare as well. As you see, it's ruins there. Built in 1853, Major Gillem was away, of course, when David Hunter's troops came, but his wife was there, and she said, she came out on the front porch and said that she was the daughter of a Union Army officer and the wife of an Army officer, and she knew her duty, and if they had to burn her house, then so be it. And they did. Later, after the Civil War, Matthew Fontaine Maury would arrive at VMI, the Pathfinder of the Seas, and he would take up residence in the Gillem House. And more recent than that, in fact, just in this past year, we have spent $1.2 million in a major renovation of that house, returning many of its Alexander Jackson Davis features back to their original 1850s look, which you will also be able to appreciate next week. Since those days, over the past intervening 150 years, when our nation has determined that the sword must be drawn, VMI has looked upon its proud heritage for inspiration. The Cadet Corps of today subscribes to the concepts of duty, honor, sacrifice, and resolve established for them by those cadets of 1861-1865. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I am Dan Gould.